Well, you've come to the right service, because after I spoke this morning at the first service, I had a couple of people come up to me with a couple of extra points. So you are getting like the enhanced version this morning. So well done for that, first of all. As we come to the end of our series on conversations with God, we arrive at a very well-known figure from the Old Testament, that of Moses. I thought about carrying on with the story of Gideon that I started 2 weeks ago. And I really would like to look at that at some point, because the bit beyond the parts of the story that we all know really well were almost, they felt completely new to me when I read them, when I started looking at them, and they were really interesting. So at some point I might get there. It was the kind of situation where you get to a verse and you read it and you think, I've never seen that before. Has someone snuck that in there since the last time I read this? It's strange how often that can happen. Well, this was an entire chapter about the second half of someone's life that I felt like I'd never seen before. Anyway, I decided not to carry on with the story, mainly because I was worrying that if I carry on with the story of Gideon, it might be a bit repetitive. I might end up picking up on the same themes and the same points. So I thought, no, I'll do something fresh. I'll talk about someone completely different, and then you'll have completely different points, and it won't feel like you're essentially, you know, repeating the same sermon or anything like that. And now this plan started to backfire through the week as I started to realize that the story of Moses' call and the story of Gideon's call actually have way more similarities than I'd really realized before looking. But by that time, I was already committed, so here we are. And at the same time, I do have a funny feeling that's exactly how it's supposed to be. So, Moses, more familiar to us than a lot of Old Testament figures. And this morning, we're going to look at probably the most obvious conversation between Moses and God, that of his call at the burning bush. But first of all, let's remind ourselves of who and where Moses was at that stage in his life. He was born into a Hebrew family, and to avoid him being killed, he was pushed out in the little basket that still holds his name today, into the River Nile. Rescued from those waters, he's adopted by a daughter of the Pharaoh and raised as a prince. As he grows into adulthood in the courts of a king, he is the obvious choice to become the leader of his true people and to lead them to freedom. But everything goes wrong when he takes matters into his own hands, killing an Egyptian, attacking one of his countrymen, then fleeing in fear of his life when the Pharaoh hears of his actions. He ends up in the wilderness in a place called Midian, marries and settles down as a shepherd to a very different life to the one he might have expected. And I have a feeling that some parts of his life may have been quite an unpleasant change from Pharaoh's palace to the wilderness. And the run-of-the-mill shepherd's life must have been a very strange contrast to the brilliant future that once seemed to lay ahead for him. All the niceties of the Egyptian court that he's grown up trained in are completely wasted in this life. They have no place. And so the parts of his character and personality which made him who he was when he fled Egypt just start to fade away over time. And what we find as we read today is a man who, after the failure of his early attempt to play the hero of Israel, has no further thoughts of heroics in mind. He appears to have settled down and to have lived a quiet, modest life. He'd thrown away, it seems, his excellent prospects through his hot-headedness, and as he headed towards his later years, this is a man of 80 at the time this conversation takes place, what had he made of his life? The world would say a resounding nothing. After all, looking after sheep in the desert was an almost impossible come-down for a man who potentially had the chance of sitting on the throne of the most powerful nation on earth at one time. And yet, when God's call comes to him, it comes in the desert rather than the palace. And I think it may well be that call would never have come to Moses, or the Moses who lived that life of luxury and ease. So let's take a look at where we find this humble man. We're going to look at Exodus chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So picture for a moment, we have this lonely shepherd passing slowly across the desert to what is called the far side of the wilderness, which sounds like the worst possible holiday destination you could think of. Maybe to find some water, maybe to find some decent grass for grazing for his sheep. And Moses is, as a good shepherd should be, he's out in front of his flock, he's leading them, when all of a sudden he sees this strange light, which must have been very bright to attract his notice in the midst of the bright desert sunshine. Now, in this part of the world, it's possible for a group of shrubs or plants to just spontaneously burst into flames. That can happen. It's not totally unheard of. And you notice Moses isn't frightened or even drawn to the fire itself initially. The fire isn't singular. What is unique is that any ordinary fire would have gone through those plants in a flash, leaving them grey ashes in no time flat. But this strange, steady light, which draws Moses' eye, persists long enough to really get his attention, to see why the bush, not why it's on fire, but why it's not burning up. And then as he walks over, we hear God call his name. Moses, Moses, he says. That doesn't really seem like a point in itself, but the fact that he calls his name twice, God only does that three other times. For three other people in the Old Testament. He says it to Abraham and Israel before him, and to Samuel some years later. And I could go into why this is important and what it signifies, but I think it's probably enough to say that this type of call is reserved for some really important people, some people who God worked amazing things through. So even in the greeting that God gives Moses, he's saying this is not an ordinary conversation in and of itself. He is setting him apart at this point. And what's more than that, as God speaks through the burning bush, we have what is known as a theophany. What is a theophany? I hear none of you cry out. I'm going to tell you anyway. It's just a visible representation of God, some form or manifestation of him that can be seen by the human eye. It's important to say this isn't actually God himself who appears to Moses. In a sense, it's Moses isn't actually looking at God. In these times, it's just a representation of him. Moses couldn't look full in the face of God and survive it. And you notice Moses hides his face immediately when he realizes who he's talking to. And this picture of God as the burning bush which is never consumed by fire, this plant which is sustained in the midst of the heat of the flames, that also seems a very strange choice for God to speak through that. But it actually fits perfectly because it represents this idea that God is never exhausted by action. Even after creating the entire universe, he takes a day off for our benefit to model to us how we should live, not because he needed to recharge his batteries. And also, God is light. There is absolutely no darkness in him. He is the bright shining light, which has absolutely no intention of ever dimming, let alone going out, in the way that all the rest of life as we know will. So God speaks through this burning bush because it's a way that we can understand something of him and an aspect of him that we probably don't think about all that much. And as we read on, we find God explaining to Moses the time has come to end the Israelites' period of slaves and to rescue them, to bring them out of Egypt into a country all of their own, the promised land, which has been set aside for God's people. And it's here we get this very odd phrase describing this place that is often used but not necessarily often understood. Because have you ever thought about what the phrase a land flowing with milk and honey means, or what a land like that might actually look like? Because when I was little, or littler, I always saw it as this kind of gloopy mess of milk and honey running over all these hills, and it didn't seem very appealing. And because all this liquid is sitting on these hills, all the milk's kind of gone off, and it's just, it's a picture that it never really struck me as a place I would really want to live, and let alone fight for the privilege of living there. And the problem is, because I had that in my head from being quite young, I've never quite been able to shake that image. Now, I'm sure none of you have these bizarre ideas, but just in case this has never been explained to you, this phrase is really talking about cows and bees. After all, honey comes from bees, and milk comes from cows, sheep, goats, camels, duck-billed platypuses, whales, dolphins, and cats, amongst other animals. So the Orby idea of a land flowing with milk and honey really means is a land that is firstly capable of supporting livestock. So we're talking about green fields. And then also that the whole area would also be teeming with flowers so the bees could pollinate and make honey. To Moses, who is a man who has lived in the back end of beyond for the best part of four decades, this picture must be a very attractive one indeed. And what was interesting after the first service was that someone came up to me and said, when they were in Israel, they were struck by the fact that Israel actually isn't very green. And they asked someone and said, what is this idea of land of milk and honey? Because there's not fields as far as the eye can see. And the person came back to them and said, yeah, but have you been to Egypt? It's like, it's about contrast. And then we come to the point where God directly calls Moses from verse 10. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. So we have this man, Moses, whose life had been actually very ordinary and orderly for such a long time. He knew one day would be almost the same as the day before, and the next day would probably be very similar again. Very little variation until one day he'd just be too old, too frail to go out with the sheep. That was the way his life was heading until today. So now go, God says to him. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Talk about changing your plans. Moses thought he knew where things were going, but God had very different ideas. Suddenly, God thrusts Moses into the thick of dangers and difficulties, at the center of his plan to save his people. But Moses, quite understandably, immediately shrinks back from that invitation. And if anything shows that the impetuous figure who killed an Egyptian in the heat of a moment is no more, this is that moment. You see, unlike Gideon, who we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and whose call by God, as I said earlier, is at times very similar to the story we read here, I don't think it was necessarily fear which held Moses back. Rather, it was extreme humility. All of his self-confidence has been knocked out of him over the passage of time, and age and solitude have molded him into something rather strange, and yet strangely appropriate for a shepherd, because Moses in this moment actually appears to be a little bit sheepish, because he no longer thought anything of himself at all. And so Moses says, probably not the most clever response that you could give to God in this moment, because he says to him, who am I that I should go? And it almost doesn't matter about the rest of the sentence, because God's answer in that moment will always be the same when he's called. He says, I will be with you. And in effect, he's saying, it doesn't matter who you are, because I'll be there as well. If we were to pick a winner in a fight between Moses and Pharaoh and the whole Egyptian army at his back, it's not even going to be close. Pharaoh wins, hands down, every time. But if you change the equation even ever so slightly and say Moses plus God against anyone in the world, any nation, anything else in the universe, you could possibly throw out that combination and it doesn't have a prayer. Humility is a good characteristic for us to have. But at the same time, we have to have that rightly aligned with a correct view of God, or we're just going to get things hopelessly out of proportion. If you want to hear an example of how this conversation really should have gone, we find one later in the Old Testament, in the book of Amos, where the prophet Amos is describing the moment where God called him to ministry. This is from 7:14. I was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I was a shepherd, and I also took care of sycamore fig trees. But the Lord took me from tending the flock and said to me, go, prophesy to my people Israel. Now then, hear the word of the Lord. That's how you respond to a call. God told me to prophesy, so here I am. This is what he's got to say. Moses hadn't yet learned this point, but I think he did come to. It's the idea that you can take the lowest possible thought that you can have of yourself. That's fine. But you take it and you put it together with the highest possible idea you can bring yourself to imagine of God's power, love, and faithfulness. And what you do then is you put those two things together so that when he calls you or asks you to do anything, that your view of God is so big that it completely dwarfs and hides the idea that we have of ourselves. And all we can see is what God can do. And what we can't see is what we think we can't do. But in the meantime, Moses has another question. He says, when I go to the Israelites and say your God has sent me, if they ask for your name, what should I say? Now this question really strikes an odd chord, because to us, names are, to a certain extent at least, they're just tags for people that we have, so we don't have to walk around all day going, oi, you, no, not you, you, the one in the blue coat, mum, yeah, that's it, okay. Names are just labels. They don't mean anything, but names meant something in Old Testament times. If a person had a name, it usually the meaning of the name was significant in their lives. And nothing had more significance than the name of God, which Jews consider so holy that they won't even write it out in full. But the reason why this question is actually quite a good one is also because the Israelites had been in Egypt for so long, and Moses knew this firsthand, the Egyptians worshipped so many different things. They almost worshipped anything. They worshipped cats. I mean, I love cats, but they worshipped cats. So Moses is saying to God, what name shall I give you to distinguish you from all the false rubbish which they worship over in Egypt, both the Egyptians and to some extent some of the Hebrews themselves? God gets the question, and he gives him two good answers here, because he calls himself, first of all, I am who I am, by which he's saying, I am the God who has always been, will always be, and will never change from the beginning of time to the end of time. I will always be the same. I am who I am. And secondly, God refers to himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, by which he means he is the God of the nation of Israel's ancestors. He's the God of the promise, who told Abraham his descendants would outnumber the stars in the sky. That's how God identifies himself to Moses, and that is a very good answer to be going to the Israelites with. But then we have a further question, and here we're looking at the beginning of chapter 4. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? A staff, he replied. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. So Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Then the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. Now put it back into your cloak, he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they do not believe you or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. So Moses asks this very good question. What happens if I get there and I say all this and they don't believe me and don't listen to me? And it's an interesting one because actually the first call of Moses is that he's been called to go and speak to the most powerful world leader on the planet and ask for the release of an entire people, the free workforce that the Egyptians have been benefiting from for many years. And Moses is more worried about speaking to the Israelites, his own people. And the thing is, that's his history coming back to haunt him at this point. At one time, he thought himself a good candidate to be their leader. But after all this time, after all these years, and after the way that he left, if he's not completely unknown, he is the last person that they would take as a leader, and he knows it. He's worried about the Israelites and whether they'll think he's fit to lead them, considering his actions when he was in Egypt. So Moses is given by God not one, not two, but three signs to prove his credentials to them. Surely now he must be satisfied. This must be the end of the questions. Well, not only is that not the case, I would say this is the point where Moses' questions really start to change into something a little bit more like objections. Initially, I genuinely think there's almost like a shock factor to it all. Moses is just left reeling from the unexpectedness of God's call, and he's just trying to catch up with it all. Like when you're just told something that's completely overwhelming and you're trying to sort through like a million thoughts, you can almost hear him saying, okay, God, why have you picked me? What if I go there and, I mean, who do I say is sending me? And what if they don't believe me? He's kind of got all these thoughts and he's just kind of almost trying to understand. And this is the point where, for me, that starts to change a little bit as we read on now in verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say." But Moses said, "Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else." Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, "What about your brother, Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform signs with it." Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Let me return to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive." So the first objection, and Moses is continuing on his theme that he feels he's not up to the task. This time, because he's not a natural speaker. The language of slow of speech and tongue actually translates into something like heavy of mouth, which is a really odd phrase in itself. But a number of people have looked at that and said, maybe Moses had a stutter or some kind of speech impediment. And if that was the case, that would be a reasonable objection on his part. Another idea was the fact that Moses had been out of Egypt for 40 years. And so his language skills in Egyptian are actually quite rusty. And so the idea of standing before the Pharaoh and then trying to remember the finer points of a language he hasn't used in almost a lifetime is a bit beyond him. I think there's possibly something to that as well. But another idea, and one which I really had never thought of before, was the idea of being slow of speech and tongue was of somebody who actually struggled to think on their feet. Slow in speech because he's slow in thought. He needs time to consider his words. And if you're being sent to negotiate the release of an entire people from the Egyptians, you're going to need to be able to think on your feet, respond quickly, and adapt to shifting situations. Whatever the meaning behind it, Moses considers himself to be the last possible natural choice for this job. And God's response is really just a longer version of what he told Moses initially when he first answered God with, "Who am I that I should go?" God said then, "I will be with you." And what does God say in response here? He says, "I will help you speak and teach you what to say." And basically what he's saying is, "I will be with you." Different question, same answer. And I think God's response of "I will help you speak and teach you what to say" kind of lends itself to this view that Moses was maybe as worried about knowing what to say than just the quality of his public speaking only. But God, regardless, promises to make his abilities fit for the task, because that is how God works. In 1 Corinthians we read, God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. And this is exhibit A of that situation. If Moses had been a natural speaker with a sparkling wit and the negotiation skills of a diplomat, and he'd gone to Pharaoh and he'd freed the Israelites, how does Moses' leadership development go following that when he knows it was his strengths and his qualities that won the day? Do you think that would have led to a humble, godly leader? Or do you think that would have led to a self-confident, arrogant leader reliant only on his own skills? Moses clearly remembered enough about Egypt to know that you would have to be a madman to stand in front of Pharaoh and demand that he releases the Israelites. And he also knew enough of the personality of his own people not to be particularly eager to have the task of leading them, which, by the way, was proved to be true over and over again when he did lead them. So the call that God has on Moses' life, you can use a lot of words to describe it, but attractive is not one of them. But he knew this duty was being laid on him by God, and what he needed to do was focus on the nature of a person who was calling him and stop focusing on the nature of a person being called, himself. Unfortunately, he does the opposite. And what he does in verse 13 is he outright refuses God. He says, no, God, please send someone else. Now, bear with me on this. I love chocolate ice cream. And there are times when I feel that it is almost irresistible, that it is impossible to say no to. However, apparently, with just a little bit of self-control, it can be done. And maybe one day I'll find that out for myself, although a rather large part of me hopes not. However, when God has a call on your life, that is irresistible. You cannot even refuse your way out of it. Although you can, as we see here, anger God through an attempted refusal. God, who is slow to anger and rich in love, even he has an end to his patience. And that anger here is completely justifiable, understandable. Because to go through that whole conversation, for Moses to know that he is talking to the Almighty, living God, who has chosen you out of the whole population of Israel, set you aside and told you that he is going to be with you every step of the way, he is going to carry you through this. And the best response that Moses can come back with is, "No, it's not for me. Send someone else." I get a bit angry, you know, so God, you know, I can really understand why God would just... But even while God's anger burns against Moses, he's still so kind and so patient with him. And he addresses two concerns that Moses has, one which he has voiced and one which I think is present but unspoken. Firstly, Moses' brother Aaron, an excellent speaker, is already on his way to him. So this was clearly part of a plan all along, although I guess that might be because God knew what Moses was going to say before he said it. I'm not going to go further down that road because things get really confusing that way. But I do also think there's a fear here in Moses about having to go to Pharaoh and the Israelites alone. He's an outcast and a fugitive from these people, if he's known at all, and he's going to have to present himself to both as a leader and a figure of authority, the man who was a murderer. Now, God has said on at least two occasions he will be with Moses. But the fact that's not been sufficient for him, I think Moses just wants someone physically standing with him in this. And again, I think we can all understand that. And I think God does too. He understands Moses' weaknesses without him needing to raise them. What we see is the fact that if God calls, then he'll be with us, will give us what we need, and will provide who we need when we need them. And so Moses relents at last and begins to make plans for his return to Egypt. Now let me just say, Moses did not turn out to be the perfect leader, but he was a very, very good one, through some of the most trying circumstances you could possibly imagine. From crossing the Red Sea with the entire Egyptian army at their heels, leading an unbelievably stubborn and thankless people through the wilderness for year after year after year, where their only food source was that which God provided them on a daily basis. The fact that God gave him the Ten Commandments. So many things he did because he trusted God and led his people out of that trust. I just wanted to say that because if you consider what we've looked at on its own, you would quite rightly have some serious doubts about the kind of leader that he was going to make. But he did well, not because of anything in him, but because God delivered as always, on his promises to equip Moses for every work that he had called him to. Now, this conversation between Moses and God made me think about my own communication with God, about our communication with him. And essentially, sometimes, where we feel that we want to argue with God, but we can't because it's not appropriate. Or we do, maybe in like the heat of a moment, and then we feel guilty because we're not sure if it's okay to do that. Now, I think there are some very valid reasons why you should argue with him on occasion. And the first of those is that I can honestly say I'd rather you argued with him than didn't speak to him at all. Because that's so often what we do. If we get angry with God, or if we're frustrated with him, what we do is we disengage entirely. We step right away from God. So I would take you wrestling with God over an issue or a problem than just trying to carry on without him every time. But just to bring some balance to that view, I can't stress enough that having the right attitude in these moments is really important. Do I think it's ever appropriate to shout and swear and rail against God? No, not even in our lowest moments. Is that a right response? In all of this, you need to remember that God is God. And that should affect how you approach him. But you also need to remember that he loves you and he cares about the situation which is causing you all this anger. And sometimes just that realization alone is enough to take some of the sting out of our anger. The really funny thing about questioning or arguing with God, it seems like it's kind of doing something against him. But actually, when we do that, we're honoring him in a way because we're turning to him for the answers. When we say to him, how could you let this happen? Or where are you in this? Or I don't understand. Help me to understand. You're saying you trust him to hear you in those moments. And you're trusting him to respond, to answer you in those moments of frustration. So if you ever feel anger at God and think, well, I can't pray when I feel like this, that's exactly the moment when you need to pray. Don't forget who you're talking to, but keep in mind that just as any of you or I, we can disagree, but we can still be friends. All of us can wrestle with God, but still honor him and grow in our relationship with him, even in the working out of the hardest parts of our lives. In fact, we're far more likely to mature as Christians by facing up to him in those times rather than allowing walls to spring up between you and God without even acknowledging it, let alone dealing with it. But the final picture I'd like to leave you with today is that of Moses' life as a whole. Now, he lived to a ripe old age of about 120, and very neatly his life essentially splits up into three lots of 40 years. For the first 40 years, he grows up in the palace of Pharaoh as an Egyptian prince. He thinks he sees where he can take action, but does so in his own strength, without any leading from God, and ends up running ahead of God's purposes by taking matters into his own hands. And things go horribly wrong. For the next 40 years, he lives very modestly in the desert, and the man Moses changes into is one barely recognizable from those early years, to the point where when God calls him into service, Moses lags behind God's purposes. God is almost dragging him, kicking and screaming towards them, saying, I've chosen you, I've called you, there is no getting out of this. So in his earlier years, he ran ahead of God. In his middle years, he lagged behind God. But eventually, in his later years, he found that perfect place, walking hand in hand with God. And again, when I was speaking to someone afterwards, they put it so much better and so much more succinctly in this. And it was, for the first part of his life, Moses thought he was someone. For the second part of his life, he found out he was no one. And the third part of his life, he found out what God can do with no one. And this morning, I just want to pray for all of us that we would find that balance in our lives. Not to run ahead and think we can do it all, but not that we would fall behind and think that we are somehow not enough, but that we would be walking alongside him, side by side, into the plans he has for us, whatever those plans might look like. Amen.
Father, I want to thank you for Dom. I want to thank you for his willingness just to be open to you, Lord. And I pray that the word that you have brought this morning will be one that we don't just listen to and then move on from, but that you work in our hearts and our lives, Lord. Help us to recognize your call on our lives. Help us to recognize the fact that in our own strength we have nothing to offer, but in you the most amazing things can happen. Thank you, Father.